Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
President Barack Obama preparing to outline a game plan to deal with Islamic State militants and Somalia's al-Shabaab. A new leader. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington. President Barack Obama says he will outline his game plan to deal with Islamic State militants this week. Mr. Obama told NBC TV's Meet the Press today he will meet with congressional leaders Tuesday to discuss the matter. He will then make a speech on Wednesday, which is the eve of the 13th anniversary of the 9/11 terrorist attacks on the U.S. Mr. Obama stressed the U.S. will be part of an international coalition and carry out airstrikes to support Iraqi and Kurdish troops.
This is not going to be an announcement about U.S. ground troops. This is not the equivalent of the Iraq War. What this is similar to the kinds of counterterrorism campaigns that we've been engaging in consistently over the last 5, 6, 7 years.
He said that in the course of the months, the momentum of the Islamic State will be blunted and its territory reduced and defeated. The U.S. military today launched strikes in western Iraq near Haditha Dam. U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel, speaking earlier, said securing the dam was crucial.
Haditha Dam is a critically important facility for Iraq. It is, I think, the second largest hydroelectric dam in Iraq.
Meantime, Somalia has removed its top intelligence officer and is on high alert following the Monday killing of al-Shabaab's leader in a U.S. airstrike. National Security Director Abdullahi Mohamed Ali was appointed in July as part of a major overhaul of Somalia's security services and had only held the post for a few months. A government spokesman announced the firing, saying that it happened at today's cabinet meeting after Ali failed to fulfill his commitments. The decision comes as Somali officials put the country on high alert after the militant group al-Shabaab confirmed the death of its leader and also appointing a new leader to take over. President Barack Obama says the U.S. military would help in the fight against the Ebola virus in West Africa. Speaking on Meet the Press, Mr. Obama said the U.S. military assets can set up isolation units and equipment and provide security. He warned that if efforts are not made now, the outbreak could spread around the world and should be made a national security priority. Meantime, Sierra Leone is ordering people to stay at home for 3 days this month as part of an effort to stop the spread of the Ebola virus. Theo Nickel is Deputy Minister of Communications.
Initially, it's a three-day lockdown, but after the 3 day, government will consider whether if the result shows that the spread is minimized. We may be tempted to increase the days.
Ebola has now killed more than 2,000 people in West Africa. Residents of Donetsk reported hearing heavy shelling today near the airport. The possibility of artillery fire raises the fear that the truce signed Friday by rebels and the Kiev government is on the verge of collapse. A spokesman for Ukraine's National Security Council in Kiev said that rebels in Donetsk appear to try to retake the airport, which has been under government control since May. Meantime, officials in Mariupol said one woman was killed, three people wounded in shelling overnight in that city. A French journalist held hostage for months by Syria has identified one of his captors as Mehdi Nemouch, the French national accused of killing four people at the Jewish Museum in Brussels in May. Journalist Nicholas Hennin says Nemouch was one of his extremist militant jailers from July to December of last year. A new report from the United Nations Children's Agency, UNICEF, says violence against children is widespread around the world. Some 95,000 minors were murdered in 2012. 120 million girls experienced sexual violence. From the United Nations, VOA's Margaret Bashir reports.
Just because we don't always see violence against children does not mean it does not exist. This is the message of a new UNICEF report called Hidden in Plain Sight, which analyzes violence against children in 190 countries. UNICEF Deputy Executive Director Geeta Rao Gupta said Thursday that violence plagues children all around the world, regardless of their economic and social circumstances, culture, religion, or ethnicity.
It takes many forms: physical, sexual, emotional. It occurs in places where children should be safe, their homes, schools, and communities.
Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Meantime, an Afghan judge has sentenced seven men to death for the gang rape last month of four women. I'm Marty Johnson reporting.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Impoga.
Last month, in August, we took a regional approach to allocating funds to support air services in those three countries.
More funds are mobilized to respond to the Ebola outbreak in West Africa.
With the introduction of the mobiles that came to our country not long ago, you walk on the streets there, you will find people are on phone.
Women in South Sudan benefit from the growth of the mobile phone sector.
I'm teaching behaviors and how to best suit the situation that you're in. So we're actually improving your social skills because etiquette is the fine art of getting along with people.
And a unique school in South Africa teaches the art of good manners. Those stories and more coming up right here on Nightline Africa. The Ebola outbreak in West Africa has so far killed over 2,000 people. The United Nations says there are now more than 3,500 confirmed cases of Ebola in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. Late last week, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon urged the international community to support the World Health Organization's roadmap and to provide $600 million for supplies in West Africa. As UN Radio's Derek Imbata reports, some help is coming in.
Relief agencies in West Africa have received more than $6 million to respond to the ongoing Ebola outbreak, according to the UN humanitarian agency, OCHA. OCHA says the money has come from the UN's Central Emergency Response Fund, CEF, which is pooled from a number of countries, the private sector and individuals to deal with emergencies around the world. It points out that $2.7 million has been allocated to Guinea, $1.9 million to Liberia, and $1.5 million to Sierra Leone. Jens Leike is OCHA spokesperson in Geneva.
The first allocations from the Rapid Response Fund, that's between April and June, focused on health and food response. Last month, in August, we took a regional approach to allocating funds to support air services in those three countries. And this approach has benefited the UN Humanitarian Air Service, which has received an allocation of $3.8 million.
Jens Leike said that more requests for CEF money to support the Ebola response are currently being processed for September. Derek Mbata, United Nations.
The growth of the mobile phone sector in South Sudan is connecting women across the country and is contributing to gender equality, and that's according to a senior government official. Despite poor infrastructure and low internet bandwidth, Africa's newest country is hoping that mobile phones can also be used for so-called e-education, that's learning through the electronic medium. UN Radio's Paul Conley asked Rebecca Joshua Okwachi, Minister of Telecommunications and Postal Services in South Sudan, about the challenges the country faces.
Our challenge is that we don't have infrastructure, which is enough to cover our country. We are still even battling with the usage of internet now because we have a very limited band. Also, because of the war, we also had a big challenge of education in general, and therefore having people in the sphere and the field of ICT is also very limited.
What are you seeing in terms of how the population itself is using technology nowadays?
We are still not connected in terms of fiber optic. We are only using satellites, and therefore it's expensive, and we don't have enough broadband for us to use other applications. But what's good and is actually encouraging is that with the introduction of the mobiles that came to our country not long ago, you walk on the streets there, you will find people are on phone.
still also not all the applications are being used, but today the woman in the market in South Sudan, you will find her, even if she has not gone to school, with all the illiteracy level that we have, they are able to use their mobiles. They are able to communicate even with their relatives, even those who are in the cattle camp. This is where we keep our animals. You know, today, those elderly people who have not gone to school are able to use their mobiles. So for us, it's promising, and it also shows that our people, the people of South Sudan, are open for receiving technology and even for using it.
What particular outcomes would you like to see in South Sudan that can be of real and practical support for you to help you on this journey that you've just outlined for us?
Areas like rural access, because many of our population still live in the rural areas. We need to reach out to the population so that they can get the services and also benefit from the connection. We hope to be part of, in the near future, of e-education, and that is an area also very close to my heart in terms of educating our children. If we can use technology, it will help us. I also promote women development. That is also very important, and it's very close to my heart because it also helps us as a country as we move towards development. We are also carrying the gender perspective for us. Put together, I think that will help us to have the nation growing at the same time and at the same level, and all will contribute to the development of our new nation.
Rebecca Joshua Okwachi, Minister of Telecommunications and Postal Services in South Sudan, she spoke with UN Radio's Paul Connolly. Team building and good management are essential to the success of any business. Some consultants cite studies from journals of sociology and industrial psychology. But one American entrepreneur bases his success on common sense and the values he grew up with in the era of segregation over 50 years ago. Clifton Tolbert is an African-American businessman and speaker. He's also the author of 13 books. In this part two of a two-part interview, reporter William Eagle asked Mr. Tolbert about the eight values he grew up with that can be used to improve business management.
Nurturing attitude, responsibility, dependability, friendship, brotherhood, sisterhood, high expectations, courage, and hope. All of these eight habits were people in my community, and they lived out these habits in my presence, on my behalf, and for my future. I've come to understand that those eight habits are timeless and universal.
Now, how do you incorporate those habits into your workshops? When you're teaching and giving conferences and seminars to such varied groups as NATO, into companies like Lockheed Martin, Bank of America.
You know, when I have the opportunity to work with corporate America or to work across the board with companies from around the world or with political parties around the world, the one thing that we all understand is that culture matters. Our actions are shaped by the culture that surrounds us. And whether it's Lockheed Martin or whether it's the opportunity I had in Brussels, Belgium, speaking to a gathering of NATO employees, they all understand that if the culture is not good, it literally just takes away from performance and it takes away from being your very best. Not only do you not maximize your potential, but in some regard, you diminish the outcomes of the bottom line, however that is defined. So I begin, as I go into my workshops, let's look at the culture and let's look at leaders embracing the types of principles that will not only build but sustain the culture. And that's when we look at nurturing attitude. Nurturing attitude is how do we use our time? And this is what I will ask the CEO of a company, a president, or a supervisor. You have to look at this habit of the heart as an asset to bring into your culture. You have to start with the premise that everybody matters, and you want to allocate time to support that. And then you begin to look at responsibility. And I want them to understand that responsibility is not just something in the dictionary, a term. But responsibility is the person that in the world of work, people look up
And what they tend to see gives the signal as to what is expected of them. So responsibility is the unselfish sharing of knowledge so that responsibility can emerge from that. So again, we're talking about inclusivity. We're talking about collaboration. All of those things comes about as responsibility moves into the workplace. And then there's dependability. You know, people give their words, but are they keeping their word? When I grew up in the Mississippi Delta, when someone gave me their word that I mattered, they kept that. And because they kept their word, my life was transformed. And I bring that into the workplace. Supervisors, managers, employees. We have customers that we serve. When we give our word, we have to keep that word. We have to become dependability. And our actions, if you will, within the culture of our workplace defines the outcome that we will expect. And it goes through all eight habits to courage, standing up and doing what's right. The easiest thing to do sometimes is to close our eyes and move on. But then a problem comes up because no one took the courage or the time to stand up, call something out, bring it to the attention of whomever to make sure that this was dealt with right then and there. So you can't have a good collaborative, inclusive work environment without men and women being literally brought to bear that courage is absolutely essential. Then, of course, there's high expectation. Why hire a person if you're not expecting that person to do his or her best? And if you're not willing to provide them the tools that would allow them to be their best? And even more importantly, when someone does well, don't just accept this as the norm, but make this something to celebrate and to showcase so that others understand that their good efforts are well noted, well appreciated, and a real part of the success of the organization.
So it's a very open team. It's a very collaborative team where employees are encouraged to speak up and to contribute and also to question things if they seem to be going awry.
Most definitely. Every person needs to really understand the vision, needs to really understand the mission. And when those two are embraced, it becomes much easier to understand your place in that mission and within that vision. And then it becomes even easier to understand that there is no place for narcissism in a very successful environment. That's why building community, as I call it, becomes the job and the opportunity of every employee on a daily and continuous basis.
That was author and entrepreneur Clifton Tolbert. He's the author of 13 books, including 8 Habits of the Heart, Embracing Values That Build Strong Communities. He was speaking with VOA reporter William Ego. In early August, Meron Wadne was crowned Miss Africa USA 2014. Meron says the pageant is not only about beauty, its organizers demand contestants to contribute to the betterment of Africa. The beauty queen recently sat down with VOA's Yahes Wahib and started first by talking about her upbringing.
I was born in Ethiopia, Horn of Africa of course. I came here when I was 7. I started school here. My upbringing was very good. My parents did everything for me, went to high school and university here. But they always made sure that I still knew my culture, my language. I still know Amharic. I read it, write it, and speak it very well. I played sports while I was in high school, especially basketball. And then I was always dancing was my other thing too, our cultural dances. I graduated high school and then I went along and had a full scholarship and played at Bowie State University. And I graduated with health and sciences. And after I graduated, I started my nonprofit. And then eventually modeling, pageant, all came along.
So you got what, the scholarship for sports?
Yes.
At Bowie State?
Yes.
So you still play basketball or...
Yes, I run and shoot around. I run more so I can stay in shape, and I shoot around every time I get a chance with my dad, even now. We did that like Friday morning.
Okay, so you're what, 6'?
6 feet, a little over 6.
A little over six. Yes. So basically what, your height, you know, modeling, basketball, I mean, it's an advantage or a disadvantage?
Oh,
I mean,
very good advantage, to be honest with you. I even hated... Yes, grateful, but I hated being tall when I was younger. I'm like, why am I so tall? And then when I got to college and then everybody's, oh, I put on heels and got into modeling business. I don't go nowhere without my heels now. I'm like, yes.
And back to the pageant, Miss Africa 2014. So how did that come about? Was there any, was there a process you went through to become Miss Africa USA?
Yes, a lot. First, you have casting and auditions. You first have to compete for your country first. Every country has to do that. So I had to compete for Miss Ethiopia, USA first. Everybody else had to do the same thing as far as Miss Sierra Leone, Ghana. Everybody has to do that. You first have to get selected by a delegation. So semifinals, we had to come out and present your platform and walk on stage. And then we all did that. And then I won Miss Ethiopia USA. And then after that is when I had to compete for Miss Africa, representing Ethiopia in the pageant.
What do you mean when presenting your platform?
Platform. This pageant, as far as Miss Africa USA, it's not just about your beauty. It goes way more than that. She wants to know why you're here. Why do you want to shine light on Africa? That being said, one of the requirements is being forks. And what future do you want to hold? You want to work? You want to do in Africa? So. Those some qualification requirement for you to win and get into the pageant as well.
That's not just beauty, but other qualifications as
well.
Yeah,
you have to have a purpose.
So where in the United States did this pageant take place?
This year it happened in Bethesda, Maryland, at the Strathmore Theater. Everybody came from all the contestants. It depends where you competed and what country won. So we had contestants that won as far as the girl that was even second place was Uganda. She was Texas. So we had various states. Last year, that girl that won Miss Ethiopia USA was from Vegas. So it depends on how you qualify to win for your country.
So how many African countries were represented this year?
18.
That was the current Miss Africa USA, Meron Wadne. She talked to VOA's Yahya Swahib here in our Washington studios. South Africans are flocking to a unique school in the commercial capital, Johannesburg. The South African School of Etiquette teaches the art of good manners. Learning such skills, says the school's director, improves people's business and personal lives immensely. Viewers Darren Taylor reports in this third part of our series on remarkable enterprises in South Africa.
When people find out what Courtney Carey does for a living, their body language changes.
They stand up straighter, they might not talk to me as much, but when people do ask me what I do, instead of saying I'm an etiquette consultant or I'm the director of an etiquette school, I'd rather say I help teach people the social skills to feel comfortable and confident in any environment.
So the elegant blonde in a black suit and white lace shirt has a degree in politics, philosophy, and economics. She's also a graduate of both the New York School of Etiquette and the Protocol School of Washington. Carey appears eminently qualified to direct South Africa's first school of etiquette. It's inside a French chateau-style mansion in the opulent Johannesburg suburb of Sandhurst. For Carey, this place of marble fountains bubbling from manicured lawns and crystal chandeliers gleaming from pressed ceilings is the perfect setting for her unique enterprise.
I'm not teaching good manners. I'm teaching behaviors and how to best suit the situation that you're in. So we're actually improving your social skills because etiquette is the fine art of getting along with people.
She says people spend years learning technical abilities at universities, but never spend a minute on perfecting their social flair.
If you can interact confidently, you will build better relationships or stronger relationships, get better contracts, and earn higher profits, essentially. So
Carey insists that employing soft skills, as she calls them, will get you a great job or win you a lucrative tender. She teaches her pupils, be genuinely attentive to people, look them in the eye, and never interrupt them.
Make the people around you feel important. Make them feel special. Because if you can do that, that is a true gift, and that is also charisma. If you are charismatic, people like you. So if someone likes you, they will support you. They will help you. They will choose you over somebody else. You will get the promotion over someone else. They'll choose your company and that contract over someone else.
Carey gives instruction on polite cell phone behavior. She says many South Africans are losing business and friends through careless use of the devices.
Hello. Sorry, I must go now. I must take his call.
Carey maintains it's bad manners to pay attention to your phone rather than to the person in front of you.
No phones should be seen at any social occasion. They should not be on a table. They should not be in your hand. They should be put away, and if you need to, you can check it every 45 minutes.
She also teaches people to deliver a good toast.
Begin, be brief, and bow out. Begin, say why you're toasting. Be brief. So we're paying homage to somebody here and what they've done really well in their lives. And here's to Darren.
According to Carey's rule book, President Barack Obama made a perfect toast during his state visit to South Africa in June 2013.
To President Zuma and Madam Zuma for their outstanding leadership in carrying on the great traditions of the South African struggle. Pula.
Carey teaches a course called The Art of Dining at her school. Bad table manners irritate her. In a smart restaurant in Johannesburg, patrons tuck into food. Some bang their plates and cutlery and eat with a relish of ravenous beasts.
This is terrible. People leaving spoons in their cups when they're drinking coffee.
I didn't.
No, you didn't. I checked before I said that. Swapping hands with the cutlery and shoveling the food.
Another of Carey's courses instructs strong-willed, independent women on how to be more feminine by appreciating men's chivalrous acts.
I've had women tell me they think chivalry's dead, but yet when a man opens a door for her, she doesn't think it's necessary to say thank you. To her, chivalry is dead because it's dead in her mind. What I do teach women, though, is that if a man does open the door or do a chivalrous act, you thank him and you look him in the eye.
On a crisp winter's evening, Carey closes an etiquette session and gives a final address to pupils.
Unfortunately, I don't have a magic wand to make you immediately perfect. The hard part starts now, and that is implementing and practicing these skills.
Then she plays a motivational DVD. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
Hello, I'm Kim Lewis.
And I'm Yehias Wuhib.
Together we host the Voice of America's informative program, Africa News Tonight.
We present a thorough summary of the day's events, featuring interviews with newsmakers in Africa and the world.
Also, Sunny Young drops in live with sports, and we have features on science, health, and business.
Tune in Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC right here on The Voice of America.
Hello, I am Shaka Sali. Join me on Straight Talk Africa every Wednesday as we discuss topics of special interest to Africans, including politics, economic development, press freedom, health, social issues, and conflict resolution. Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital Lagos, and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. But let's kick off with Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's go straight to Lagos and join Segun on the dot at DMA. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Douglas, and good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, September 7th. It's a busy weekend for African football as the final round of qualifiers for the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations got underway across the continent on Friday. Some 28 teams are playing in this round, which is the group phase of the qualifiers. The teams are divided into seven groups of four teams each. Each team will play six matches between now and November 19th, 2014, after which the top two finishers in each group plus the overall best third place team will advance to next year's finals in Morocco. African champion Nigeria did not have a good start to its campaign to defend its title in Morocco. The Super Eagles of Nigeria saw red in the hands of the Red Devils of the Republic of Congo as they were handed a shock 3-2 defeat at home on Saturday. Fellow 2014 World Cup teams Algeria, Cameroon and Ivory Coast got onto a better start after they all won their matches. There were also home victories for Burkina Faso, Gabon and Tunisia, and an away triumph for the tiny Cape Verde Islands. Zambia, which won the Nations Cup in 2012, was held to a goalless draw at home by Mozambique, while Ghana also drew at home, 1-1 with Uganda. Congo became the first country in 33 years to win a competitive match in Nigeria, beating the Super Eagles 3-2 in the southern city of Calabar. Nigeria was last beaten in a competitive home game when it lost 2-0 to Algeria in a World Cup qualifier in Lagos in 1981. In Saturday's match, Efe Ambrou headed Nigeria in front after 13 minutes, but Congo captain Prince Onyango equalized 3 minutes later. French-born striker Thierry Bifoma put Congo ahead 2-1 in the 48th minute before he converted the penalty in the 54th. Congo had been eliminated in the early knockout rounds, but was given a reprieve when opponent Rwanda was found guilty of fielding an ineligible player. Congo's defeat of the Super Eagles added to the problems haunting Nigerian football. World Soccer's governing body, FIFA, will ban Nigeria if the controversially elected head of Nigeria Football Federation, Chris Giwa, does not step down by early Monday. The ban will prevent Nigeria from playing South Africa in Cape Town on Wednesday in their Group A match day 2 and lead to disqualification from the Nations Cup. Meanwhile, Nigeria's head coach Stephen Keshi has said the defeat may be what his overconfident players require to sit up.
I'm talking to the boys, you have to be very aggressive, force to the ball. You know, I've played against Congolese team before. I know they play this tip-tap, tip-tap. You don't let them play. And we scored the first goal and everybody went, hey, hey, hey. And then that was it, you know. It's a shame that we had opportunities, we could not score, mostly second half. First half, they were winning 2-1. But it's part of the game. Maybe it's going to be a good lesson for the players. Maybe too much confidence. We'll see how it goes in South Africa.
What did you tell them at halftime?
I just told them they're not playing a game. They're not themselves. They're not playing. They're just watching. They're second to the ball. And they need to change the mentality. And they came back second half and you can see the difference second half. But, you know, you're playing against a team like this, they're going to come back behind and pack the balls. And that's what they did in second half.
For his part, the vice chairman of the Congolese Football Federation, John Paul Fuani, expressed happiness that his team could beat football giant Nigeria.
I am very happy because, you know, the Nigeria is the big team in the soccer. Today, I have not seen the good team Nigeria. I think the Nigeria has some problem maybe in the team, but which is the soccer. Today, maybe it's not good for the Nigeria, but maybe next time. But the Nigeria is a good team. It's a good team. I haven't seen your team. Yeah, Nigeria is a good team. Nigeria is a good team. It's a good team. Because here we have one player in Congo, Thierry Bifuma. We have seen Thierry Bifuma, the number 30. He's a good player. You are seeing he has moving your defenseur. I think the Congo is can gone long.
In Kumasi, Ghana needed a penalty to avoid defeat at home to Uganda, drawing 1-0 in Group E. Ghana had to come from behind after a long-range effort from Tony Maweje gave Uganda a surprise lead on the stroke of halftime. The hosts were awarded a penalty when Dennis Iguma fouled Abdulmajid Waris in the 50th minute and Dede Ayew converted the spot kick. In Lubumbashi, Cameroon put a desperate World Cup behind it as debutant Clinton Ndjie and striker Vincent Aboubakar scored in a 2-0 victory over the Democratic Republic of Congo in Group D. Stephen Mbia produced a captain's performance at left-back, having taken the armband from Samuel Eto'o, who announced his international retirement last month. In Abidjan, Ivory Coast began a new era without Didier Drogba, who has also quit the international stage by defeating Sierra Leone 2-1 in the other Group D game. Gervinho scored the winner as the Ivorians came from behind to beat their West African rivals. Sierra Leone was severely affected by the Ebola virus outbreak in the run-up to the game, with support staff prohibited from traveling to Abidjan by Ivorian health authorities. In a Group B game in Addis Ababa, Algeria beat Ethiopia 2-1. However, heavy rain meant that the other Group B match between Mali and Malawi was called off till today, Sunday. In other matches, Yassin Chikawi scored a late penalty to give Tunisia a come-from-behind 2-1 win over Botswana. Samson Bingwe scored with a powerful shot as Gabon beat Angola 1-0. Burkina Faso, runner-up at the last finals, overcame Lesotho 2-0, while Cape Verde scored three times in the first 24 minutes to win 3-1 in Niger. Now, let's remind our listeners that match day 2 in the Nations Cup qualifiers is scheduled for Wednesday, when another set of 14 matches will be played. Here are the full results of the 13 matches played on Friday and Saturday in the qualifiers. First named teams are hosts. Group A, Sudan 0, South Africa 3. Nigeria 2, Congo 3. Group B, Ethiopia 1, Algeria 2. Group C, Burkina Faso 2, Lesotho 0. Gabon 1, Angola 0. Group D, Democratic Republic of Congo 0, Cameroon 2, Ivory Coast 2, Sierra Leone 1. Group E, Guinea 2, Togo 1. Ghana 1, Uganda 1. Group F, Zambia 0, Mozambique 0. Niger 1, Cape Verde 3. And Group G, Senegal 2, Egypt 0. Tunisia 2, Botswana 1. Staying with football, U.S. Major League Soccer club DC United has signed on Samuel Nkum, who has been on Ghana's last two World Cup rosters. The club announced the signing of the 25-year-old player on Friday. Nkum has 46 career appearances with Ghana. He has been playing professionally in Ukraine since 2011, even though he has been on loan to French club SC Bastia last year and Platinias FC of Greece this year. Another Ghanaian, defender Kofi Opare, is also playing at DC United. Finally, athletics. Kenyan Jeffrey Rono upstaged compatriot Jeffrey Mutai to break the course record at the 10-kilometer Prague Grand Prix on Saturday evening. Rono smashed the course record with 27 minutes 28 seconds, the second fastest time in the world this year. Mutai, who is preparing for the defense of his New York Marathon title in early November, finished 4 seconds behind in 27 minutes 32 seconds. Another Kenyan, Nicholas Ball, was third in 27 minutes 38 seconds. After the race, the energetic Andy Edwards spoke with champion Jeffrey Rono.
You were level with the other Jeffrey for much of the race, and then with what seemed like about a couple of minutes or so of running left, you drew away. You must have been feeling very strong.
Yeah, in fact, I was feeling good. I was feeling not dead, so that is why I decided to pull away, because I was still having another extra soft energy.
We're talking quite a few minutes after the race has finished and the sweat is still pouring off you. It was warm, well, to about 20 degrees, but the humidity was high, 85%. Did it feel a tough race?
No. In fact, what I was feeling is just only the pace. The pace was, it was excellent, the pace. Yeah, but with humid, it was somewhat hot, but I am used to because I used to train at noon and in the morning, so I'm used to hot weather.
You've run the second fastest 10K in the world this year, and it's a very fast time anyway. What are your ambitions? Are you going to stay at 10K or half marathon? You've beaten Wilson Kipsang and Geoffrey Mutai. Those are big names to have beaten.
Yeah. I think I will go with the advice of my coach. Yeah, if he told me that you are ready enough to run marathon, I'm ready for it because I have been training for marathon even. Yeah.
And you said to me before the race, when you felt on form, you thought you could beat anybody. It's really looking like that, anybody in the world. Is that really how you feel?
Yeah, anybody who is racing my race, provided it's a medley, road race or marathon. I think everything is possible. Yeah, everything is possible because we are all men. And with good training, I know nothing is impossible.
That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Douglas the Mighty Mpuga in Washington.
Thank you, Segun. Segun on the dot. Adeyemi will be back again next Sunday for another look at African sports right here on Nightline Africa. Yes, it's Sunday here on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to listen to music from the continent. So here we go.
Makanisi penso dona makanisi ekeseni Moteme kotinda yokolo ba penso to ekoboya kosala likambo Oh minawe Oh ngana yo nakoko kate kosala yo likambo Epa inakuti ona banda tango boko solo la nakangi makofi Mote mamoto ni makani simpesu wa ekotinda na sala bituma Oh minawe Oh ngana yo Tukubu manaka kapona bolingo Eloko babengi bolingo, mpasi na bisengo esangana Epa imosusu na kenda kabanso bakolenge la kangana bomoto Oh, oh minawe, oh ngana yo Okufunda nele via mwana ya moto
Ateito Oh minawe Oh ngana yo Nakoko kate kosala yo likambo Inakutio na banda tango boko solola na kangi makofi Mote mamoto ni makani sipesu wa ekotinda na sala bituma Oh minawe Oh ngana yo Tukubu manaka kapona bolingo Eloko babengi bolingo, pasi na bisengo esangana Epa imosusu na kenda kabanso bakolenge la kangana bomoto Oh, oh minawe, oh ngana yo Okofuta nele via mwana ya moto
Nini na sala poade ito azonga na kobanga te akimanga na moto yo libela ngo bapangie
basingana komona bato basusu bakosekanga bayebe bai na nzali te bolingo oyo ebeli mama
makasi kati ya nzoto nakoki mpe nakobeta mbanda kasi motema eboyi mama na titie
nakobanga kokima e adeito adeito songa ndako na sengi yonse na maloba monamu adei
That was our Sunday music spot. I sincerely hope you enjoyed that music. And it was coming to you from Nightline Africa here at the English Service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa. One man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Here is Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Peace and stability brightened in Mozambique last week when Afonso Daklama, the leader of RENAMO, returned to Maputo after 2 years' absence. Daklama complained that the government of President Armando Guebuza had not been complying with the Rome Treaty and other understanding, and he therefore returned to his central region hideout, causing much concern in the country. His fighters conducted low-level insurgency. The government was able to contain these attacks, but instability reigned because of the fear that investors may not be willing to invest in the country. During the 15-year civil war in Mozambique between 1975 and 1992, RENAMO caused heavy damage. Because of its sabotage, Zimbabwe under President Mugabe had to place security forces in the Baiga corridor to ensure the transport of Zimbabwe goods and products through Mozambique. Who is Afonso Taklama? During the Civil War, he was a shadowy and mysterious figure. Initially, he was sponsored by some Portuguese businessmen who were trying to maintain the power of influence in Mozambique that prevailed under the Portuguese. Later on, the apartheid South Africa intelligence took over and controlled him, and it was very, very unstable. So an NGO in Italy, Catholic NGO, then sponsored negotiations in Rome. United States and the United Nations were observers. At the end, it was agreed that there would be a United Nations peacekeeping force to organize new elections between the reigning Frelimo party and Renamo. Money was given to the clamor to convert his forces from rebel to political party. He lost that election, but he has always maintained that he would not be a Savimbi of Angola who had rejected the result of an election and returned Angola to civil war. But the last 2 years, he became very uncomfortable and he went to the central region. In coming to Maputo last week, he expressed satisfaction with the agreement reached with President Guebuza, and he declared that he would participate in the October 15 elections for president and parliament. This was a very comfortable prospect because there were fears that should Renamo boycott the election, there would be greater instability in the country. Now, the prospects are that in the election, it is more than likely that Renamo would win the election and President Guebuza may have another second term. Will this provoke the clamor to return to hiding in his central stronghold? That is very doubtful. The prospects for not winning is due to the fact that the northern region and the southern regions are strongly strongholds of Frelimo. Only the central region is in strong support of Renamo. Finally, there is also the view that the disturbances caused within the circles of Renamo was due to the fact that President Guebuza had not handled Renamo as skillfully as former President Chissano did. And this will now be a test as to whether President Guebuza and Frelimo will be able to accommodate Renamo. For example, reintegrating his forces into the army and the police. If this is done, then there are great prospects that Mozambique will continue to be a prosperous country. I thank you.
That was one man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN and Secretary General for Political Affairs.
Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us tonight. I hope you enjoyed the program. And as you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. I hope you join us again next Saturday. Have a good evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Less than 3 years ago, on October 23, 2011, Libyans celebrated the country's liberation from longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi. A broad coalition of groups composed of people from all walks of life banded together, disregarding regional, religious, tribal, ethnic, and political differences, to rid the nation of a brutal regime. After months of fighting and the loss of too many lives, a bright new future finally seemed within reach of the people of Libya. Unfortunately, it would not be that easy. Rival groups that had united to defeat a common enemy soon turned on each other and began to fight in earnest to further their narrow agendas. Still, despite the upheaval, the country seemed to be moving forward, holding general elections in July 2012 and another one in June 2014 for a new House of Representatives that was seated in August. Since May, the three-year-long upward spiral of violence escalated. In Benghazi, assassinations and attacks on government forces continued in the wake of former Libyan National Army commander Khalifa Haftar's attacks on Islamic extremists, which he then declared part of a broader campaign against all Islamists in Libya, whom he likened to flesh-eating microbes in a May 20th interview. In mid-July, rival militias began a battle for control of Tripoli International Airport. After 5 weeks of fighting, hundreds of deaths, and millions of dollars worth of damage to Libya's infrastructure, the Operation Dawn affiliates gained control of the airport. These Operation Dawn affiliates then proceeded to declare a new government, a move denounced by the country's official government. And the fighting continues. In a joint statement, the governments of the United States, France, Germany, Britain, and Italy strongly condemned the escalation of fighting and violence in and around Tripoli, Benghazi, and across Libya. The five countries called on all parties in Libya, including the government and all militias, to accept an immediate ceasefire, engage constructively in the democratic process, and to stop all activities that risk undermining it. "We support the efforts of the UN support mission in Libya in this regard," said the statement. "We call on Libya's interim government and the elected House of Representatives to adopt inclusive policies that benefit all Libyans and to build a government that meets the Libyan people's needs for security, reconciliation, and prosperity. We encourage the Constitutional Drafting Assembly to immediately pursue the drafting of a document that enshrines and protects the rights of all Libyans. Further, we encourage the international community to support Libya's elected institutions."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.